iconic Pike Place Market and the waters of Elliott Bay. He could take a ferry from there to someplace, but where? Or he could go northwest on 6th Avenue, taking him downhill toward the Space Needle. He wasn't going up there. That was a mistake people always made in books and movies. They headed up only to fall a long way down. His remaining option was heading south on 6th, down toward Pioneer Square. Something drew him in that direction. Perhaps it was instinct again, pulling him toward Los Angeles, his home, hundreds of miles south. He started walking fast down the street, rolling his suitcase along with him. "Wait a minute," Margot said, hurrying after him. "Your flight to Denver isn't until 4. We can leave your bags here and come back for them after the signing." "I'm not going to the signing, and I'm sure as hell not coming back here." He also had no intention of going to Denver or anywhere else on his itinerary. It was bad enough that they knew he was in Seattle. Margot was confused. "Then where are we going?"
"Is your phone on?"
"Yes."
"Turn it off. They can track that too."
"Who?" she asked.
"The people who were trying to kill me."
Those people were watching Ian and Margot on the media wall in Blackthorne's Situation Room. The huge screen showed the two of them from different angles, culled from an array of cameras in the area. Building security cameras, ATM cameras, traffic cameras, and even the cell phone cameras of people taking selfies and sightseeing photos, and then posting them to social media.
"They are heading west on 6th Avenue," Seth said.
Cross nodded.
"How many parked vehicles can we access within a 4-block radius of their location?"
Seth typed a few keys. A satellite view of the downtown Seattle streets showed up on the media wall. Lots of red dots, each representing a parked car that could be remotely hacked, blinked along the streets and within parking structures.
46, Seth said. "Of those, 21 have ignitions that can be started through the manufacturer's smartphone app. 14 of those cars have parking assist, and 5 have full autopilot capability."
Cross smiled.
"Find me one with autopilot that's parked on a steep hill."
Chapter 10. Ian and Margot were on 6th Avenue and crossing against the light at the intersection with University Street. Ian had no idea where he was going. All he knew was that he couldn't stay where he was. So his only plan at the moment was to keep moving and not to be a sitting target.
"Nobody wants to kill you," Margot said.
"You haven't turned off your phone."
Margot reached into her pocket, pulled out her iPhone, and made a show of turning it off.
"Satisfied?
You think I'm crazy?"
"I think you're paranoid from drugs, drinking, and sleep deprivation," she said. "We've all been there."
"I didn't take any drugs," Ian said, walking fast.
"But you drank everything in the minibar," she said. "I can smell it."
"I was trying to numb the terror."
It was a lie. The terror came after the crashing guilt. That's what he was really trying to numb, but he wasn't ready to tell her about that yet. He was barely ready to admit it to himself.
"You would have done the same thing after what I've been through."
"I was with you all day yesterday," Margot said. "The closest you came to getting killed was when you made a pass at me."
"The attempt on my life didn't happen yesterday. 2 months ago, one of the burners on my stove was left on. I didn't smell the gas because my allergies were really bad, so I took a bath to clear my sinuses and relax," Ian said. "I was in the bathtub at the other end of the house when the place exploded. The stuffy nose saved my life. They didn't anticipate that."
"They?" Margot asked. "Who are they?"
They were carefully tracking Ian and Margot on the media wall.
"There's a loaded Mercedes S-Class with autopilot parked on Madison above the intersection with 6th Avenue," Seth said. "If Ludlow keeps walking south, he'll cross the intersection."
"Let's see the car," Cross said.
Several windows popped up on the media wall, each showing a different security camera view of a black Mercedes sedan, facing downhill on a very steep street. Cross glanced at Victoria.
Do you have access?
I do. Victoria hit a button on her keyboard and started the car's ignition. Ian and Margot approached 6th Avenue. The light was red. A half block uphill, a black Mercedes rolled away from the curb, without a driver. But they didn't see that.
They tried again 3 weeks ago, Ian said, stopping at the corner. I was riding my bike on Mulholland, up in the Santa Monica Mountains. I do that every weekend. I was going too fast. I tried to slow down, but my brakes failed. I swerved into traffic, got clipped by a car, and went flying off a cliff. I smacked into a rock outcropping on my way down. It broke my fall and my arm. Otherwise, I'd be dead. Now I know my bike was sabotaged, and the car hit me on purpose.
You're just having a run of bad luck.
They are. I'm not. I'm on a winning streak. I'm still alive. But they will try again. They have to.
The light turned green, and Ian bounded into the street, rolling his suitcase behind him. Ian was centered in the Mercedes hood ornament like it was a gun sight. He didn't see the black car speeding down the hill straight for him. But Margot did. She dashed into the intersection and took a flying leap that would have made Clint Straker proud, tackling Ian and taking them both down, the two of them barely clearing the car's shiny grill. They hit the ground hard. The Mercedes smashed into Ian's suitcase, splitting it open in a spray of clothes. The Mercedes roared past Ian and Margot. They both looked up to get a glimpse through the flying underwear and socks at the insane son of a bitch driving the car. But there was nobody in the driver's seat. They were still absorbing that chilling fact when the car blasted into the intersection and was T-boned by a bus. The bus bulldozed the Mercedes down 6th Avenue in a shower of sparks, broken glass, and ripped sheet metal, and plowed it into the row of cars ahead, causing a chain reaction of rear-end collisions that stretched half a block. Ian propped himself up on his good elbow and stared down at the intersection. It looked like the aftermath of a monster truck derby. People on the sidewalks and from within the surrounding businesses rushed into the street to help the injured and the trapped. There was nobody driving the car, Ian said. He felt oddly calm, and it came through in the matter-of-fact way he shared his observation with Margot. He'd felt a different kind of calm when he'd sat up naked in his bathtub, his hair singed, and realized that most of his house was gone. That calm was shock, the mental numbness that comes from experiencing a traumatic event. This calm was certainty, the intellectual peace that comes from achieving clarity and understanding. The CIA was definitely trying to kill him. But how did they know he would be crossing that street at that moment? It's a steep hill, Margot sat up, dazed and sore. The parking brake failed. It happens.
Uh-huh, Ian said.
Then why was the engine running?
Because some dipshit left his car double-parked with the engine running while he ran into a building to do some dipshit errand, Margot said.
He deserves to lose his fucking $100,000 car.
If the car was idling at the curb when the brake failed, Ian said, why was it rolling straight down the center of the street?
It wouldn't be. Someone had to turn the wheel and keep it steady.
Ian was right, and Margot knew it. But he didn't see her eyes widen in fear as she accepted his argument. His gaze was fixed on the office building across the street and the array of security cameras out front that were aimed in their general direction.
Chapter 11. Ian Ludlow's face on the media wall was like an angry giant peering down at the Blackthorn operatives through a window. He knew they were there, watching him, even if he couldn't actually see them. Every operative was waiting to see how Cross would react to the failed operation. But Cross was thinking about the rogue element, the one complication, behavior, object, or occurrence in any operation that couldn't be anticipated, regardless of whether a mission was simple or complex, improvised or carefully planned. Because Cross was exceptionally good at his job, more often than not, the rogue element ended up being only a minor annoyance. Sometimes it was even a source of amusement, easing the tension of a deadly operation. But it could also lead to devastating failure and many lost lives. The rock outcropping, the bathtub, and now a woman were the rogue elements that had saved Ian Ludlow from a premeditated accidental death. Those failures were embarrassing, but the fate of the larger operation wasn't jeopardized yet. They still had time to clean up their mess. However, the risk to them increased with each passing hour that Ludlow still drew breath. The key to overcoming the rogue element, whenever it appeared, was operational flexibility and a clear head. What Cross needed now were more facts before he could decide on a course of action. So when he finally spoke, his voice was even and calm, betraying neither his anger nor his frustration.
"Who is that woman with Ludlow?"
Seth typed a command on his keyboard. One of the camera images of Margot on the media wall froze. Targeting points appeared on Margot's face as the facial recognition software analyzed her features against the millions of other faces in their database. Her driver's license, University of Washington student ID, credit card photos, and a blizzard of other bits and pieces of her life appeared on the big screen. Operatives around the Situation Room began shouting out details about her as they found them.
"Her name is Margot French.
She's an author escort. Ludlow's publisher hired her to take him around town for his events.
She's 24 years old, single, and a college dropout.
She lives in a studio apartment in the university district.
She used to work at the bookstore Ludlow visited last night.
She owes $2,758 on her credit card, buys her groceries at Whole Foods, and her most recent Amazon purchase was a lipstick vibrator."
Cross asked the room,
"Does she have any special skills?"
"She was a goalie on her high school soccer team in Walla Walla. She plays guitar and sings at local coffee houses."
"She's got 74 positive reviews on Yelp for dog sitting."
Victoria said, "She's an easy kill."
"So is Ludlow, and we failed 3 times, Cross said.
Ian shrugged off his messenger bag, which had broken his fall, and got shakily to his feet, using his good left arm to push himself up. Once he was standing, he didn't pick up his bag. He decided to ditch it and the computer inside. If he kept the MacBook, it would reveal his location to the CIA the instant it was turned on. He felt claustrophobic, even though he was out in the open. He could feel the world closing in on him.
"We have to get out of here," he said.
"Not me."
Margot stood up and examined the scrapes on her arms.
"I'm done with this crazy shit. I'm going home."
She started to walk back the way they came, but Ian grabbed her arm.
"You can't go home," he said.
"You're in danger."
"No, I'm not."
Margot easily yanked her arm free from his weak grasp.
"Whoever they aren't after me."
"They are now.
You see those cameras across the street? Do you see the ones behind us? Do you see the traffic cameras in the intersection? There are cameras everywhere, and they can access them all," Ian said. "That's how they knew where I'd be, so they could hack a car to run me down. They know that you saw it. They are watching us both right now. I'm sorry, but now you're in as much danger as I am."
She looked around at the cameras and thought about what he'd said. Ian knew what he was saying sounded like the rantings of a lunatic, and yet he could see from the expression on her face that it was beginning to make sense to her. That's because his explanation was sensibly crazy, sensible in the context of what had just happened, but crazy if considered on its own. He'd used that argument in the writer's room to justify all kinds of stupid stuff on Hollywood and the Vine, and in the privacy of his own office on plot points in his books.
"Who are they?" she demanded. "Why do they want to kill you?"
Ian heard sirens approaching. The police and fire departments would be here in minutes. They were running out of time. "I promise that I will tell you everything, but right now we have to disappear, or we're dead."
Why can't we just wait for the police and ask for their protection?
Because they can't protect us. Nobody can. You have to trust me. At least until we're somewhere safe and I have the time to explain. Or we're both going to be killed today.
She had the look on her face of a struggling math student trying to solve a difficult algebra problem in her head.
Fuck you, she said. Follow me.
Margot took off downhill, and Ian followed her. They ran through the intersection, weaving through the cars and the pandemonium, down toward Fifth Avenue. The camera feeds on the media wall tracked the pair's zigzagging flight on foot through the streets and alleys of downtown Seattle. The Situation Room was still silent, although plenty of activity was going on. Half of the Blackthorn operatives present were working the covert op that was unfolding in Seattle. They were frantically accessing private and municipal cameras throughout the area to maintain visual surveillance on the two targets. They were also actively monitoring street and air traffic, police and fire department communications and deployment, and any other activities that could potentially impact the outcome of the op. The remaining operatives were focused on the aftermath of the Honolulu plane crash, monitoring the FBI, Homeland Security, and NTSB investigations, tracking news and social media coverage, and doing background checks on all of the airplane passengers, flight crew, airport ground crew, and investigators working the case.
Based on what we know about Ludlow and French, Cross said, can we anticipate where they are headed?
Pioneer Square, Seth said.
What's there that's significant to them?
The Crime of Your Life bookstore, Seth said. They're late for Ludlow's signing.
Chapter 12. Ian and Margot ran out of an alley onto Cherry Street, stopping to catch their breath on the sidewalk directly across from the Crime of Your Life bookstore, which was on the ground floor of an old office building. A poster-sized blow-up of Ian's book cover filled the window, and a banner over the entrance read, Ian Ludlow signing today.
You can't be serious, Ian said. This is the first place that they'll look for me.
Follow my lead.
She looked both ways for traffic, crossed the steep street, and waited for him at the door to the bookstore. Ian hesitated, but decided he had no choice. He dashed across the street, and she held the door open for him. The tiny bookstore was jammed with bookshelves from floor to ceiling. Even the checkout counter, where the store manager was stationed, was essentially a waist-high set of bookshelves. The store could barely hold the 24 people, mostly middle-aged women who stood in the three narrow aisles, clutching hardcover copies of The Dead Never Forget. He forced a smile and went inside. The manager's name was Dottie, presumably for her galaxy of freckles and her affection for polka-dotted dresses, and the instant she saw Ian coming in, she loudly declared, Ian Ludlow is in the building! And then Dottie led the customers in applause. Even Margot joined in.
Sorry I'm late, Ian said. I've been on the run all morning.
It was a line worthy of Clint Straker, and Ian knew it. He couldn't stop being a writer, always thinking of the next line in one of his thrillers. But he was living in a thriller now, and it was no thrill at all. Pictures of Ian Ludlow, taken by customers in the store and being posted to Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and Pinterest, began showing up on the media wall almost immediately after his arrival. It was the only view Cross had of what was going on inside the bookstore, though he had multiple camera angles on the exterior.
Why did he go there?
Cross wondered aloud.
Maybe he thinks there's safety in a crowd, Seth said.
Or maybe he can't pass up a chance to autograph his books, Victoria said. Neither explanation satisfied Cross. He frowned and folded his arms under his chest. What was Ian Ludlow thinking? Ludlow was certainly carrying a heavy emotional and psychological burden. He believed the CIA was responsible for the crash of Trans-American 976. killing hundreds and wounding even more, and he knew that it began as his idea. That had to scare him. There was also the terror of knowing he was being watched and relentlessly pursued by killers. In fact, only moments ago, he'd barely escaped being run down by a remote-controlled car. So how did Ludlow react? He ran to a bookstore to autograph some books. Not just any random bookstore, but the one he was scheduled to be at right now, where killers could already be waiting or could show up any minute. Cross didn't have any killers in Seattle yet, but Ludlow didn't know that. What Ludlow did was insane. Had he cracked? Or was he seeking solace for his anguish, or distraction from his fear, in the adulation of his fans while he figured out what to do next? That was the sort of superficial, ego-driven thing an insecure writer might do. Or perhaps he'd simply realized the futility of running, that he couldn't escape his fate. So, Ludlow decided that he might as well enjoy the last moment of happiness he was likely to have in the short time he had left alive. That explanation made some sense to Cross. It was a logical and rational reaction. And maybe if Ludlow had been alone in his flight, Cross could have accepted that as a working theory. But there was still Margot French, the rogue element to consider. She'd saved Ludlow's life and then run to the bookstore with him. He didn't believe that she did it because she was worried about them being late to his signing. No, there had to be something more there, too. What was she thinking? More important, what had Ludlow told her? Nothing about this felt right. Cross was certain that he was missing a crucial piece of information.
"Bring up every camera you can access on the entire block," Cross said to his operatives. "Public or private, interior and exterior. Run it all through real-time facial recognition. If Ludlow and French show their faces, I want to see them."
"Ian's not feeling well," Margot confided to Dottie while Ian posed for selfies with some of the attendees. "May he use the bathroom?" "Of course, you know where it is." Margot moved away from the counter and took Ian gently by his good arm as she addressed the crowd. "Mr. Ludlow will be right back." She led him through the crowd to a door in the back of the store. The door led into a cramped storeroom full of books and cleaning supplies.
"What are we doing here?" Ludlow asked.
"Disappearing."
"Everybody in the store knows we're here."
"Don't be an idiot," she said. There were two more doors in the room. One door was ajar, revealing a cramped bathroom. She closed the bathroom door, went to the other door, slipped the bolt, and opened it, revealing a rickety set of wooden stairs descending into darkness.
"This way," Margot said. "Hold on to the railing as you go down. I don't want you breaking your neck before I get an explanation for everything."
He followed her down the stairs. As they neared the bottom, Ian's eyes adjusted to the darkness, and he realized that diffused light was coming from somewhere. The air was musty from moisture and lack of circulation. It smelled like history. He made a mental note to remember that description. Ian found himself in what appeared to be an alley between two buildings, which made no sense at all. He found it very disorienting. It didn't help that he was sleep-deprived, hungover, and crashing from the adrenaline jolt of his near-death experience. Margot led him out onto what appeared to be an underground street that was lined on both sides with dirt-caked, cobwebbed storefronts with bricked-up doors and windows. It was like the exterior set of a western street from an old movie that had been rebuilt in someone's basement. The dim light that allowed him to see it all was coming from filthy glass-cubed skylights embedded in the sidewalk above their heads. The muddy ground was littered with beer bottles, soiled mattresses, and fast food containers. Here he was underground, with walls all around him, and yet his claustrophobia was gone. Here he felt free. Nobody could see him here.
"What is this place?" he asked.
"Old Seattle."
She hurried through the underground maze, and he struggled to keep up with her. It wasn't easy running with one arm in a cast in the best of circumstances, much less in half-darkness over rutted dirt and patches of mud.
Pioneer Square is built on Puget Sound muck. It used to flood here all the time. So in the late 1890s, the city began raising the streets.
How did they do that?
They basically built bridges on top of the old streets. The second floor of every building became the new ground floor, she said. But it didn't happen overnight. For a while, people still used these underground streets to get around and do business. That's why there's skylights in the sidewalks overhead. Some of the homeless come down here for the night and for shelter during the winter.
How do you know so much about it?
It's not a big secret, she said. There are tours of a few buried streets that have been restored by repainting signage, scattering around some wooden barrels and wagon wheels, and adding a few dusty mannequins dressed in old-fashioned clothes. It's a rip-off that caters to morons.
But at least the air on those tour streets probably wasn't tinged with the lingering sense of stale beer and urine. The farther away they got from the bookstore, the more the underground smelled to Ian like a public bathroom on Santa Monica Beach. Even so, he'd never seen a place like this.
This would be a cool location for a killing.
She gave him a look.
Isn't that what we're trying to avoid?
Good point, he said. Chapter 13. Cross scanned the images on the big screen wall and realized that there weren't any new pictures from Ludlow's book signing event posted on social media.
When was the last time a photo was posted of Ludlow?
3 minutes ago, Seth said.
That wasn't good. Cross's instincts were telling him something was wrong.
Call the bookstore, Cross said to Victoria. Tell them you're Ludlow's editor, and you need to share some great news with him right away.
Victoria picked up the phone and made the call, introduced herself, and asked for Ian. Cross tuned out the one-sided phone conversation, his eyes scanning the camera feeds, looking for anything amiss. All he saw were the crowds of people in Pioneer Square going to and fro, most of them with earbuds and holding paper cups of coffee. Something Victoria said brought his attention back to the call.
"Could I speak to Margot while I'm waiting?" Victoria said, then covered the mouthpiece with her hand and informed Cross, "He's in the bathroom."
"How long has he been there?"
"For a few minutes," she said. Margot was with him, too.
That was damn peculiar. Had they left the store somehow? Blackthorn had the block under visual surveillance from multiple angles. All the faces were being scanned by the facial recognition system, so their targets wouldn't be lost in a crowd. Cross or the system would have seen Ludlow and French if they'd emerged onto the street anywhere on the same block. But they hadn't showed. Something on the screen caught his eye. Not a face, but a word. Cross tapped an icon on his touchscreen, and in doing so enlarged one of the camera feeds from Pioneer Square on the media wall. The camera was trained on the Victorian wrought iron and glass cupola in the center of the cobblestone plaza. It was a bus stop. Behind the cupola bus stop was a six-story, block-long sandstone building, with a front entrance dominated by a masonry arch with Pioneer Building etched into it. On either side of the arched entry were storefronts. Above one of the storefronts was a sign advertising the Underground Tour. Cross pointed to it.
"Tell me about that."
Seth typed a query on his keyboard and looked at the result.
"Pioneer Square is built above the old city. A small portion of the buried streets have been unearthed and restored for tours."
"What about the rest of the underground streets?"
Cross asked.
"Most of them are filled in," Seth said, scanning the text on the screen. "But many are not."
"That's where Ludlow and French are," Cross said. "Show me all the access points to the underground."
A map of the underground was superimposed on a satellite image of Pioneer Square on the media wall. Blinking blue dots representing dozens of access points appeared on the image and were spread over several blocks.
"Those are all the ways in and out," Seth said. "Some are manholes on the streets and sidewalks,
Others are the basements of buildings.
We've lost them, Victoria said. Cross knew she was right, but it was only a temporary setback. Ludlow and French had to surface sometime in Seattle, and it would be in front of a camera somewhere. It was inevitable and inescapable. It was a fact of modern life. Privacy was fast becoming obsolete. The key was to be ready to act when the moment came. He addressed the room.
This is a priority one fugitive search. Access every camera in the vicinity, public and private, live and recorded, and run everything through facial recognition until those two are found. Hack anything with a lens. Security cameras, ATMs, taxis, smartphones, the $6 million man's eyeball. Be creative and proactive. I want a deep dive into Margot French. Open her email, her bank accounts, everything. No detail is too small. If she uses toothpaste, I want to know the brand and fluoride content.
Cross turned to Victoria.
Get our asset on a plane to Seattle, right now.
What are the sanctioned parameters?
Put them both down, Cross said. I don't care if it looks like an accident or natural causes anymore, as long as it doesn't look professional.
She nodded. We'll leave a mess.
Ian followed Margot up an iron ladder that led to a manhole cover. She pushed the cover up, slid it aside, and climbed out into the harsh sunlight. Margot waited on the edge of the hole to help Ian out. He emerged into a small park, with more hardscape than greenery, which had become a crowded, homeless encampment filled with tents and makeshift shelters made of cardboard, plywood, and sheets of corrugated metal. None of the residents paid any attention to Ian and Margot. She slid the manhole cover back into place, spotted a bus at the edge of the park, and swatted Ian on the shoulder. That's our ride. They ran to the bus and hopped inside just as the doors were about to close. Margot flashed a transit pass, and Ian dumped all of the change in his pocket into the driver's hand. They found a seat in the back and hunkered down low, below the window frame. The bus lumbered forward. They rode in silence, mostly because Ian fell asleep almost as soon as the bus started moving. After what felt like 5 seconds, Margot nudged him awake. He sat up, blinked hard, and saw they were no longer downtown. The bus stop was located in front of a cyclone fence that bordered what appeared to be sports fields and a nature preserve. On the opposite side of the road was the University Village Shopping Center. That landmark allowed Ian to get his bearings. They were northeast of downtown, between the University of Washington campus and the upscale Laurelhurst neighborhood on the western shore of Lake Washington. They got off the bus and Ian stood for a moment, taking stock of himself and his situation. His mouth tasted like someone had used it for a urinal. His back ached from his unbalanced running. His broken right arm itched deep inside the cast. His good left arm was sore from overuse, and his head was pounding like his brain was desperate to escape. But he was alive, and that was what counted. He didn't see any cameras, though he knew there had to be some out there. But he didn't think the CIA was watching him now. Seattle was a big city, and at least for the moment, he believed his pursuers didn't know where to look. But he wasn't fooling himself. Margot had bought them time to think, to take a breath, but they hadn't escaped. Margot trudged up the street, east toward the residential neighborhood. Ian hurried up alongside her.
Where are we going?
I'm a dog sitter. One of my clients lives up here, in a big house on the lake, and won't be back for 3 days. We can stay there.
So you're a dog sitter, too?
He wasn't surprised to learn she had another job. There weren't enough authors coming through Seattle for her to make a living escorting them around. It's a lot like being an author escort, she said. I feed the dogs, take them out, clean up their messes, and hope they won't hump my leg.
I'm sensing a little hostility, Ian said.
Gee, you think? She shook her head, obviously dismayed by how clueless he was. I totally get why someone wants to kill you.
Why's that?
It's because you're a self-centered asshole.
It has nothing to do with that.
She came to a sudden stop, turned, and got right into his face, almost nose to nose.
You knew you were a target, but instead of going to the police or hiding in a cave in Malibu, you came up here and let me take you around, knowing it would put me in the line of fire. That makes you a bona fide, self-centered asshole.
I can see why you'd feel that way, but asshole! She shoved him hard and marched away. Ian nearly fell, managed to regain his balance, and then rushed to catch up with her again.
You have it all wrong. I didn't know that anybody wanted me dead until yesterday.
She kept walking without looking at him.
What happened yesterday?
A plane crashed in Honolulu.
Yeah, I know. Everybody does. What does that have to do with anything?
He took a deep breath. He was about to take a big risk. Once she heard his story, there was a 50-50 chance that she'd walk out on him. If that happened, he was afraid there was a 100% chance that she'd be killed. But he had no choice. He had to tell her.
It was my idea.
Plane crashes happen all the time. It's not exactly an original idea.
Her flippant dismissal of his revelation was not the reaction he was expecting, and it irritated him.
Yes, so I've been told. But this crash is different. I know how it was done. It was one of the terrorism scenarios I came up with 3 years ago for the CIA.
You're a writer, she said. Why would the CIA want terrorism ideas from you?
I had the same question, he said. Chapter 14. Malibu, California, 3 years ago. Ian Ludlow's Spanish-style hacienda was nestled in the Santa Monica Mountains, on a curving, secluded stretch of Mulholland Highway. It was a modest house, draped in bougainvillea and shaded by oaks. The home was built and owned for decades by Dylan Harper, who starred in the TV series Saddle Sore for its entire 20-year run. That was one of the big reasons why Ian bought the house. He grew up watching Harper as the nameless bounty hunter who wandered the West, relentlessly hunting wanted men. By the time the show ended, Harper was as weather-beaten as a wooden barn, and inseparable from the character he played. The actor, forever typecast as a Western hero, hardly worked after that. Harper's family eventually moved the senile, widowed old actor into a bungalow at the Motion Picture and Television Country Home in Woodland Hills, and sold the house to Ian. Living in a house once occupied by a television icon made Ian feel like he was part of Hollywood history himself, which was important to him, since he was sure he'd never earn a place in it based on his TV writing. He'd made money in Hollywood, but not a lasting mark. Ever so often, Dylan Harper would slip away from the retirement home, wander around the San Fernando Valley, and convince somebody to drive him to his hacienda on Mulholland. Ian would open his front door, and Harper, wearing his cowboy hat, would stroll right in and head for the wet bar, believing that he still lived there. They'd always end up spending a few pleasant hours drinking Johnny Walker Black Label and talking about Saddle Sore. Then Ian would remind Harper that it was time to get to the studio and take him back to the retirement home. So Ian's first thought when a black Suburban unexpectedly pulled up in front of his house that afternoon was that Harper was back again. It was perfect timing, too. Just moments before, Ian had been sitting in his office, struggling with the first paragraph of his new book and getting nowhere. In his misery, his gaze had drifted from his computer screen to his wall of framed TV screen credits, and then to his shelf of Clint Straker novels, for reassurance that he was actually capable of writing. Then he looked out his window and saw the Suburban arrive. He was delighted. It was the perfect excuse to spend the rest of the day drinking scotch with Harper and listening to his stories, instead of trying to write one himself. But Harper didn't step out of the Suburban. Instead, it was two guys in suits wearing those single earbuds that were common fashion accessories for cops, federal agents, and bodyguards on the job. Ian was intrigued.
The men glanced around for threats, then opened the back door for their passenger. A man in his 60s, wearing an Italian suit tailored to add some blunt edges to his roundish body. Ian decided the two guys were bodyguards and that the passenger was their boss.
What kind of boss?
His first thought was a mob boss, but he quickly dismissed it as the product of an overactive imagination. But it was a relief to know that he still had one. One bodyguard remained standing outside the Suburban, while the other one escorted their boss to Ian's door and knocked on it for him. This bodyguard was so thorough, Ian thought, he also protected his boss's tender knuckles. Ian slipped his bare feet into the pair of sheepskin Uggs that were under his desk, and in his t-shirt and sweatpants, went to greet his mysterious guest. He opened the door to a big, friendly smile from the older man, and a cold stare from the stony-faced bodyguard who stood behind him.
"Hello there," Ian said. "I don't suppose you're Jehovah's Witnesses?" "No, I'm not, Mr. Ludlow," the smiling man said. "Do you get a lot of them up here?"
"About as often as I get unexpected guests with bodyguards."
"I'd rather not travel with them, but I'm afraid they're a requirement for a man of my position."
"If you were from the Publisher's Clearinghouse sweepstakes, and you'd come to give me my $1 million check, you'd have a camera crew," Ian said. "So I'm going to guess that aliens from another planet have landed, and they picked me as their intermediary to communicate with mankind."
"I'm a senior official at the Central Intelligence Agency. I flew here from Washington, D.C. to see you."
"That was my second guess," Ian said, a smile on his face. "So why are you really here?"
"I wasn't joking," the man said. "I am with the CIA, and we need your help."
At first, Ian thought the man was still joking, but something about the steady way he held his gaze conveyed that he was serious.
"What interest could the CIA possibly have in me?" "That's what I'm here to explain. May I come in?"
"Yes, of course," Ian said, stepping aside. "I didn't get your name."
"You can call me Bob."
Bob came in, but the bodyguard remained outside. Ian closed the door and led Bob into the living room, where two matching couches faced each other.
"Can I get you anything, Bob?"
Ian resisted the urge to mime air quotes with his fingers when he said the mystery man's name.
"No, I'm fine, thank you."
Bob sat on one couch and Ian sat on the other, a wooden coffee table between them. Ian's couch faced the window so he could see past Bob to the CIA agent, who was standing outside the SUV and staring at him. The agent was probably thinking of all the ways that he could kill Ian if necessary. Would the agent use his gun? His knife? Or his bare hands? Or perhaps the garrote sewn into the lining of his jacket? It was clear to Ian now that the best way to jumpstart his imagination was to have a spy knock at his door. He'd have no trouble writing after this.
"I'll get right to the point, Mr. Ludlow. The CIA's job is to protect our nation and further its objectives by gathering intelligence and engaging in a wide range of covert actions. This responsibility includes anticipating potential threats and preventing enemy actions before they happen. That's where we need your experience and advice."
It was the craziest thing Ian had ever heard. He had no experience at all in espionage. Everything he knew about spying he got from watching James Bond movies and reading John le Carré's novels. The only thing he was qualified to give advice on was writing, and even that was something he felt uncomfortable doing.
"I write thrillers, Bob. You live them. I don't see what I can tell you that would be remotely useful. I make stuff up. I don't actually know anything." "The CIA is a vast organization of bureaucrats, analysts, and field operatives. We have the experience, the technical resources, and the special skills necessary to acquire vital information and act on it. What we lack is imagination."
Ian had lacked it, too, until Bob and his spies showed up.
"Imagination is overrated, Bob. Trust me, you don't need a writer. Certainly not this one." "You're selling yourself short. You're a New York Times best-selling author,
and a writer for several top-rated TV shows. That makes you a member of an elite group with a singular talent. We want you and a few others to come and give us the benefit of your creativity, Bob said. Successful writers like you have proven time and time again that you can create new, terrifying plots that connect emotionally with audiences worldwide. That's exactly what terrorists are striving to achieve.
But what we come up with doesn't have to work in the real world, Ian said. It just has to be entertaining.
It doesn't matter. Your inventive plots will give us a fresh perspective, expose security loopholes we didn't know existed, and help us predict attacks that we couldn't possibly have imagined ourselves.
You're saying that you need me, a man with a unique skill set, to save America.
That's one way of putting it, Bob said.
It was ridiculous, but Ian really liked the sound of it. He would be Liam Neeson in Taken, only shorter and carrying a pen instead of a gun.
I'd be a covert operative whose top secret mission is to make stuff up.
That's a better way of putting it, Bob said.
The CIA wanted him to serve his country by hanging out with real-life spies and coming up with outrageous plots worthy of Bond villains. It was an amazing offer. The only downside was that this whole super cool experience would be a secret.
I am so in, Ian said.
Chapter 15. Seattle, Washington, July 18th, 12:35 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. 2 days later, Bob flew me on a private jet to a cabin in Maine, where I spent a weekend brainstorming catastrophe with three other writers, Ian said. We had some fun, ate some great food, drank some terrific scotch, and I came home. I didn't hear from Bob or anybody else at the CIA again. I figured I did my patriotic duty, and that was that. He and Margot were walking through a neighborhood of large, expensive homes that overlooked Lake Washington. She'd been quiet while he'd told his story, and now he waited for her reaction. She cleared her throat before she spoke.
Let me get this straight. You believe the CIA carried out your terrorist plot, and now they want to kill you to cover up their involvement.
Did he detect a hint of incredulity in her voice?
Yes, that's exactly what I think. That's absolutely ridiculous. No, it's beyond that. It's insane.
He definitely detected some incredulity this time.
I'm sure there are much more believable reasons why someone is out to murder you. What do those other writers think about your theory?
They're dead, he said. Margot stopped in front of a big Tudor-style brick house with half-timbered walls, pitched gables, diamond-paned windows, six chimneys, and a four-car garage.
Dead how? She asked.
Drowning, heart attack, and drug overdose, Ian said. All within a few weeks of one another and around the same time that I fell off a cliff and my house blew up.
Margot went up to the house as if she owned the place, used a key to open the front door, and then stepped inside the high-ceilinged foyer to type a code into the alarm panel on the wall. She faced him in the doorway.
Make yourself at home, she said.
Ian went in and closed the door behind him. Two grand staircases curved up to the second floor in front of him and looked like they belonged in an opera house rather than a private home. The ostentatious display of wealth gave him some comfort. He was sure he'd be able to find some Vicodin or other opioids here. He heard a rumble and the scratching of nails on marble, and then two excited golden retrievers came bounding down the hall to greet Margot, jumping on her with delight. She was just as pleased to see them, petting them vigorously and whipping up a cloud of dog hair around her.
Meet Kim and Kanye, she said. They're sweeties.
The dogs didn't seem to care that Ian was there. Margot led the dogs and Ian down the hall and through a door into a huge kitchen that had every possible appliance, including a brick pizza oven. In the center of the kitchen was an enormous dining and cooking island under a rack of pots and pans that Ian guessed were mostly for decoration. The kitchen opened out into a surprisingly warm and inviting family room, filled with overstuffed couches and chairs. The furniture was aligned to face the stone fireplace and the large flat-screen TV above it. French doors offered a fantastic view of Lake Washington and the perfectly manicured lawn that sloped gently down to a boathouse. There were worse places to hide out for the night.
"Did Bob show you his ID?" Margot asked, which told Ian that she was still seriously thinking about a story.
"Of course not. He's a spymaster. He isn't going to compromise his identity by flashing his ID or posting his espionage resume on the web so he can be Googled."
"Then how do you know he was really in the CIA?"
Margot opened the French doors and the dogs bolted outside.
"Think about it," Ian said. "Who else besides the CIA has the resources to hack into cameras and cars?"
"You tell me," Marco said. "You're the guy with the wonderful imagination." She walked outside, and Ian did too. He went down to the boathouse while the dogs peed and crapped on the lawn. Margot cleaned up after them with a pooper scooper. He walked to the end of the dock. The water lapped gently against the pilings. He watched a small seaplane land gracefully in the middle of the lake and glide like a haughty swan toward the Evergreen Point floating bridge. It was relaxing to stand there, but his head still pounded, and now his right shoulder ached from the weight of the cast. He unbuttoned his dress shirt halfway down, exposing his t-shirt underneath, and tucked his broken arm inside the opening like it was a big pocket. It eased the strain on his shoulder, though now the weight of the cast tugged his shirt collar tightly against the back of his neck. He couldn't win. Margot dumped the dog poop into a garbage can, set the pooper scooper down beside it, and joined Ian at the end of the dock. The dogs frolicked on the lawn, glad to be freed from the house.
"What was your plot to take control of the plane?" Margot said.
"Did it involve Clint Straker seducing all of the stewardesses?"
"Passenger jets are big flying Wi-Fi hotspots these days," Ian said. "Everybody on board can check their emails, tweet, and web surf. Even the plane itself is tweeting, constantly sending out data."
Margot interrupted him. "I get it. Your idea was that the bad guys hacked the plane. But in reality, there must be hardware barriers between the Wi-Fi stuff and flight control."
"What if the bad guys had people working on the aircraft assembly line? What if they put a tiny device deep inside the plane's wiring that bypasses those hardware barriers? It allows the autopilot to be hacked by anyone with a Wi-Fi connection."
"But you were just making shit up," she said. "There wasn't a device like that."
"There is now," he said.
Chapter 16. The assassin amused herself on the short flight from Denver to Seattle, imagining all of the ways that she could murder the annoying woman in the next seat. The trouble began before they took off. The woman boarded the plane late, yammering on her phone while holding a Starbucks coffee, lugging a huge shoulder bag, and dragging an overpacked rolling suitcase. She was a chubby, fake blonde in her 20s, wearing a pink tank top and black cobra skin patterned tights, a tacky outfit that accentuated her basketball boobs and bloated ass. The woman thrust her coffee cup into the assassin's hands without asking, then repeatedly bashed her in the head with her swinging shoulder bag as she shoved her suitcase into the overhead bin. Once they were airborne, the woman cranked up the hip-hop on her earbuds loud enough for the assassin to hear, and emptied her shoulder bag full of gossip magazines onto her lap and tray table. She flipped through the magazines and took possession of both armrests while eating from a bag of crunchy Cheetos that smelled like an endless fart. It was as if the woman didn't see the assassin in the seat beside her. Of course, going unnoticed was something the assassin worked to achieve, but she didn't appreciate suffering for it. Today, the assassin was a slim, flat-chested woman, wearing glasses and a gray pantsuit, her brown hair tied into an efficient bun. There was nothing memorable or remotely eye-catching about her. The assassin traveled light, carrying a black jogging suit, running shoes and some toiletries simply so she'd have something in her carry-on bag for the X-ray machine operator to see at airport security. She would buy or steal what she needed when she got to her destination, and leave it all behind when she left. The assassin never carried weapons. She liked to improvise. It was what made her job fun. She understood why snipers enjoyed their work, but it was too mechanical and distant for her. There wasn't any opportunity for spontaneity or creativity. When the plane arrived in Seattle at 4 p.m., both the assassin and the woman, her clothes now covered with a fine layer of yellow Cheetos dust, took the courtesy bus to the car rental terminal. Once there, the assassin used a stolen credit card at Easy Rent-A-Car to book a compact Kia, and was heading for the parking structure with her suitcase when she saw the annoying woman go into the restroom. It was too inviting an opportunity for the assassin to pass up. The assassin followed her inside. The four stalls were open and unoccupied. The woman stood at the sink, washing the yellow Cheetos dust off her greasy hands. The assassin left her suitcase beside the door, came up behind the woman, and spoke in a voice barely above a whisper. "Don't worry about your hands. The mortician will clean them." "Huh?" the woman said. The assassin grabbed the woman's head and gave it a sharp twist, breaking her neck with an audible snap. She caught the woman by the armpits, dragged her into the nearest stall, and set her on the toilet. Then she went back to the sink and gave the woman's suitcase a kick, sending it rolling into the stall. She took a paper towel, reached up to the top of the stall door, and pulled it closed. The whole encounter lasted 68 seconds. It wasn't one of the ways the assassin had imagined killing the woman, but it was still satisfying. The assassin washed her hands, grabbed her suitcase, and walked out to her car. Ian was right. There was a Vicodin in the house. He found a prescription bottle upstairs in the master bedroom medicine cabinet. The tablets had expired 6 months earlier, so he dry-swallowed two to make up for any lack of potency, washed his mouth out with Listerine, and went back down the ridiculous staircase to the kitchen, where Marco was making herself a smoked salmon sandwich. He made one too, sat on the couch to eat it, and fell asleep after his second bite. It was dark outside when he awoke. One of the dogs was lying across his lap. His head wasn't pounding anymore, his backache was gone, and even his arm wasn't itching in the cast. The Vicodin had worked its magic. Margot sat in an easy chair, smoking a joint, and watching CNN on the TV. Did she bring the pot? He asked himself, or had she found some in the house? One of the dogs was at her feet, chewing on a rubber lobster. A crustacean didn't strike Ian as a logical doggy chew toy, but what did he know? Perhaps it was lobster-flavored. Ian petted the dog on his lap. "Which one is this?" "Kim. I think she likes me." "She likes sleeping on the couch," she said. "Okay," he thought, "so Margot is still pissed at me." Not that he could blame her. On the TV, Wolf Blitzer was talking with CNN's aviation expert, Sean Danielson, in the studio. The ticker tape-style headlines running along the bottom of the screen reported that the downed flight's data and voice recorders had been recovered from the wreckage. "Blitzer, the aircraft that went down in Honolulu is a Gordon Ganza 877, the new, lighter, more fuel-efficient model of the company's 876, the workhorse of many major airlines. How safe is this new plane?" Danielson, "That's a good question. This is the second tragedy related to the new aircraft, the first being the disappearance of Indonesian Air Flight 230 on its way to Hong Kong. But I don't think the issue is the plane." Blitzer, "Data transmitted automatically by the aircraft indicated that the autopilot was activated shortly after takeoff. Doesn't that contradict the co-pilot, who said in his final transmission that the plane was out of control?" Danielson, "Not necessarily. Someone programmed the autopilot, activated it, and kept it on. The simple explanation is that one of the pilots is responsible. The alternative is sabotage." Blitzer,
Which possibility do you find more frightening?
Danielson?
Sabotage. Because if they did it once, they could do it again.
What have you been doing while I've been asleep? Ian asked.